Welcome to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Scott Kelly has spent more consecutive days in space than any other American. He commanded the International Space Station on three separate missions. The last one was the most challenging. NASA selected him to spend virtually a full year in space to determine what long exposure to zero gravity conditions would do to the human body and what the isolation could do to the mind. As he describes it in his new book, Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery, the year included moments of great exhilaration, of stifling loneliness, of frustration over trying to accomplish simple tasks in conditions of weightlessness. But ultimately, Kelly got immense satisfaction that his self-discipline and dedication were put to a test that he passed with flying colors. Scott's path to becoming an astronaut is every bit as thrilling and inspiring as his work in space, and he describes that journey too. Scott's identical twin brother, Mark Kelly, is also an astronaut, and of course, he's the husband of former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Later in the show, you'll hear how Scott Kelly learned from space the news of the shooting that almost claimed the life of his sister-in-law. Scott Kelly, welcome to Two-Way Street. Thank you so much for being here.
No, my pleasure.
You took with you on your year in space the book that tells the adventures of Ernest Shackleton, a book called...
Endurance.
What was it about Ernest Shackleton's adventures that made you want that book with you, and you decided to name your book for that same with that same title?
Well, you know, his ship was named Endurance, an Antarctic explorer. And the book I read, there's a few books about Shackleton and the crew of Endurance. And this one was by Alfred Lansing, the one I read. I actually had it with me on my first long flight. The idea being that, and the second one, but the idea being that I felt like if I ever... felt really, really sorry for myself, or if the situation got so bad that I thought, oh man, this is really hard, I can't stand living here anymore, I would just open some pages of that book and think, man, I got it really good. Because those guys got marooned on the ice for almost a couple of years. It took them to, on their own, get from an ice floe in Antarctica after their ship sunk to a place called Elephant Island, later St. George's Island, where there was actually people that could help them. But when they got there, they were on the wrong side of the island. They had to cross this mountain pass in the wintertime that had never been done before. I mean, just a really remarkable tale of survival, but also leadership with Shackleton. And if you, you know, there's a quote in the book that kind of gives me, you know, goosebumps every time I even think about it, and that is, there's three Antarctic explorers, Scott, Amundsen, and Shackleton, and I'll probably butcher this, but it's something to the effect that with, for scientific discovery, give me Scott, for speed and efficiency of travel, Amundsen, and then, you know, whenever the situation is so bleak and dire, like an emergency situation where you have no other hope, you know, just get on your knees and pray for Shackleton. You know, so that's, I chose that title in some ways to honor him as like a personal hero of mine, but also, you know, I think the story of my life in a lot of respects is a story of, you know, kind of sticking with it and endurance, always opportunities to fail along the way. You know, I flew in space twice and then I had prostate cancer and had surgery and flew twice after that for 500 days in space.
So you were diagnosed before the 159-day mission, which you really wanted to go on.
Well, that was my career. I was an astronaut, and I wanted to fly in space again. And, you know, a long-duration flight, which has actually more significant or more stringent medical requirements. But I think it's, you know, it kind of shows people that have cancer that you can, you know, if with right treatment, maybe, you know, some luck, whatever, but you can continue your life and still, you know, have a future. And I think that's an important message.
Yeah, and you had a very tough decision to make, how to treat it.
Yeah.
And finally opted for surgery.
Yeah. Yeah.
And got back into space, not once, but twice after that.
Yeah, I flew in space for 20 days, then I had cancer, and then I flew in space for 500 days.
Your brother Mark, you called him up when you were diagnosed, and since you're identical twins, you said, Mark, you better get checked.
Yeah, and he had cancer too, right?
But he had it on the opposite side of his prostate from you, just like you have
a little red dot on our foreheads.
Wow.
Mirror image twins, I guess.
Okay, so let's talk about that year-long mission. You started in Kazakhstan at the Russian Space Center at Baikonur, right?
Yeah.
One of the things you talk about in the book, as you were marching out to the launch vehicle, you heard this. Земля в иллюминаторе, земля в иллюминаторе, земля в иллюминаторе видна. Как сын грустит о матери, как сын грустит о матери, грустим мы о земле, она одна. А звезды, тем не менее, а звезды, тем не менее, чуть ближе, но все так же холодны. И как часы затмения, и как часы затмения, ждем света и земные, видим сны. It's a Russian song?
Yes.
And they play it traditionally for their cosmonauts and for you as an astronaut going out to the launch pad, yes?
Yeah, every time you exit the cosmonaut hotel on the way to get suited up and then later to go to the launch pad, that's the song that plays, which is about an astronaut looking back at Earth and missing his home.
You quote some of the lyrics, and we don't dream of the cosmodrome's roar nor of the this icy dark blue. Instead, we dream of the grass near our homes, the green, green grass. And in fact, when you come back, that's one of the things that you realize you've missed so much is nature, the grass, flowers, right?
Yeah, a lot of things like that, that, you know, we don't have in space that we have on Earth. You know, interestingly enough, one of the cosmonauts, the guy I flew in space with, Gennady Padalka, he says, when we're in space, we miss Earth, and when we're on Earth, we miss space.
On that day, you began the mission, and as you walked out to the launch pad, you became part of a ritual that was begun by Yuri Gagarin, the great Russian cosmonaut who was the first man in space. What is that ritual?
So Yuri Gagarin, on his first launch into space, which was the launch of the first person into space, human, on the way to the launch pad, he had to relieve himself, so they stopped the bus at a certain spot, and he got out, he undid his spacesuit, he peed on the tire, got back in the bus and launched into space and came back safely. So ever since then, the cosmonauts and astronauts, they fly with him on the Soyuz, do the same thing.
Yeah, I would think that the suit that you're wearing would not make that an easy ritual to accomplish.
Yeah, it's a little challenging. You have to kind of undo the seal that you just pressure checked in the suit, which is kind of interesting.
So you go out to the launch pad, and here's what happens next.
Crew reporting they're ready to go. The vehicle on internal power.
Auto sequence initiated.
Less than 15 seconds, the engine's igniting. Ramping up. And liftoff. Soyuz craft now passing a speed of over 4,700 miles an hour. Getting a look now at NASA astronaut Scott Kelly there in the right seat, giving a big thumbs up.
You have launched like that on any number of occasions. You describe in the book what it's like to sit on top of some 280 tons of explosive propellant that launches you into space. Help us understand what that feels like.
Yeah, it gets your attention. You know, you're sitting on top of a bomb with liquid oxygen. In the case of the Russian Soyuz, liquid kerosene is the fuel. And, there's very few things in life that are as serious as that.
So I want to go back in time with you for a minute. On your three, starting with your days on the space station itself, I think it was on day 327 that you wrote a letter to the writer Tom Wolfe. What did you tell Tom Wolfe in that letter?
Well, I told him how important his book, The Right Stuff, was for me as a kid. Because when I was younger, going through school, I was a kid that didn't do well. I sat in the back of the room. I didn't pay much attention to what was going on in the classroom. I really couldn't. It seemed like it was impossible. I went to college eventually because it was kind of the thing we were supposed to do. And I still struggled there. And one day I was walking across campus, and I happened to go to the bookstore to buy like gum or something. Not a book. I was not a big book buyer.
God forbid you should buy a book.
Yeah, it wasn't my plan. but I saw this book on the shelf, and it had this really cool cover, red, white, and blue, a cool title. Made me pick it up. I started looking at it, and took my gum money, purchased the book, went back to my room and read it over the next few days, probably skipped class to do it, and felt like I had, traits, and I could relate to the guys that were real people, the astronauts that became the original Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts, the fighter pilots and test pilots that later became astronauts. And the book was The Right Stuff, if we didn't mention it already, by Tom Wolfe. And so I told Tom how important that book was to me because it was my inspiration to do something that I previously thought was impossible, which was being a military fighter pilot and test pilot and becoming an astronaut someday. And it wasn't easy. You might think, well, that's a giant leap. 18-year-old kid decides he's going to do that. But once I figured out how to pay attention and do my homework, really the rest of it was just some very kind of small, manageable steps, but a lot of like perseverance and, endurance along the way, because there's always opportunities to get sidetracked and opportunities to fail. So I wrote Tom an email, and a friend got it to him, and I just, thanked him for helping me get to that point in my life.
You wrote the letter from the International Space Station and took a photograph of the cover of the book, I think. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
So I imagine when I think about The Right Stuff, of course he talks a lot about the Mercury astronauts, but Chuck Yeager is the real star of that book in many ways. And I would think Chuck Yeager, one of the great, great test pilots, must have been an extraordinary inspiration for how you turned your life around.
So Chuck Yeager, yeah, very accomplished test pilot. But for me, I wanted to go into the Navy, and he was an Air Force guy. I wanted to fly in space, and he wasn't an astronaut. So I was really more, no disrespect to him. Of course, he's had an amazing career in life. But, what motivated me was more the, a little bit different path.
So we happened to talk to Tom Wolfe for another show that we're doing. And because we knew then that you were coming in, listen to a little bit about what happened with our conversation with Tom. The astronaut Scott Kelly is going to be in our studio in about a week or so. What did it mean to you to get a letter from him while he was in space in which he told you that your book, The Right Stuff, truly changed his life?
My immediate reaction was, he must be kidding. I'm not changing anybody's life. But it was a fabulous letter to get, and I think he was not pulling my leg. But he, at the time, he was a young man, completely at odds with himself, had no idea what to do. And if you read the book, you'll be struck, as I was, I'm sure, by the fact that all his life, he had enjoyed doing dangerous things, including physical things. And he's a very different human being than the people I am used to being around.
Tom Wolfe talking about our guest, Scott Kelly.
That was awesome, by the way. Thanks for doing that. Sure. Let me hear that. That was that's a real honor.
So it was that book that inspired you and put you on a path to sort of take life more seriously. But you also write about the fact that once you became an astronaut, once you started mingling with your fellow astronauts, you all shared a common memory of childhood. You talk about coming downstairs in your pajamas to watch the first moon landing. You remember that well?
You know, most astronauts share that memory, except for my brother. He doesn't remember. I don't know why. Maybe he was asleep. But, yeah, it's a common thing to see, to have a childhood memory of the astronauts landing on the moon. You know, for my era of astronauts, I think, you know, now the folks that are being selected were not even born in some cases, actually in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
They weren't born, so they don't have those memories. But yeah, the moon landings inspired a lot of us. Now, unfortunately, it didn't inspire me enough to where I was able to do my homework. Took some inspiration later on. But yeah, there were astronauts that decided right then and there they were going to do whatever it took and got straight A's and, you know, were the top performers the rest of their lives. But that was not me.
Yet once you did commit, you rose through the ranks. I don't know if quickly is the right word, but you certainly found yourself being singled out more and more for important missions and work.
Well, yeah, you know, I got picked, selected on my first try, or first application. I almost didn't even apply because I didn't think I was qualified, but then, you know, kind of sent in an application just expecting to be rejected. But, you know, what's the harm? You know, I think a lot of people in life worry about failing, but I think failing is important. Lets you definitely figure out where you stand, yeah. And you're not going to achieve great things if you're scared of always failing. And so I sent in an application at, you know, I was 31 years old and got selected when I was 32. Went to NASA as a 32-year-old Navy lieutenant, flew in space 3 years later.
It's pretty remarkable. You know, it's interesting, though. You say in the book that you always wanted to fly the most difficult aircraft, and you have a long section in which you talk about what it was like to learn to land jets on aircraft carriers, especially at night. Yeah. And you say later in the book, that was harder than I think you say than landing the shuttle. That's a remarkable section of the book. How scary was that?
I'd say about half the time at landing the F-14 on the aircraft carrier at night, I'd say about half the time it was terrifying. The other half of the time, just scary.
What's the challenge?
Well, for all airplanes that land on the ship at night, often there's no horizon. You're trying to land in this very small landing area. You use lights on the side and in the back of the ship and in the center line of the flight deck to line yourself up. Sometimes, if there's no horizon or how the weather conditions are, you can feel like you're almost upside down when your wings level. And that is a huge distraction. What made it worse in the F-14 Tomcat is it had some very poor flying qualities. It was not well suited to land on the ship. One, as an example, if you would try to make an adjustment to line up, which means I want to, let's say, turn left to line up on the runway, on the flight deck, on the landing area. In the F-14, when you did that, the nose of the airplane would yaw significantly and then would kind of like rock back and forth, which made figuring out, whether you were centered up like you were supposed to, and that took most of your attention to where the other things you're supposed to be controlling also suffered. And sometimes it was so difficult and scary that once you did land and you were trying to taxi out of the arresting gear wires, your legs would shake because of the adrenaline that was flowing through your body.
Yeah. You also, what speed were you landing at about?
The F-14, I think, if I recall, it was probably about 130 knots.
Yeah. And you don't have a whole lot of room for error because if you missed the arresting wire, getting back up off the deck is pretty tricky, isn't it?
Well, you plan for that. Every time you touch down, you anticipate that you're not going to catch the wire,
okay.
So you're prepared to get back into the air. You add full power until you stop. Once you've stopped, then you pull the engines back.
Let's take a break right now. When we come back, more with retired astronaut Scott Kelly. Thank you. you're just joining us, my guest on Two-Way Street is Scott Kelly. He spent more consecutive days in space than any other American, well over 500. On his last mission, he spent 340 days as commander of the International Space Station. Now he's written a book about that experience and about his life. It's called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Learning. Kelly came to the Two-Way Street studio with his wife, Amiko. They were in the middle of a long and tiring tour to promote his book. They'd left Chicago early that morning to get to our Atlanta studios, but they were hungry, and so they arrived a little late after making a stop at an iconic Atlanta fast food joint. As I began asking Kelly about some of the experiences of the Mercury astronauts who he'd so much admired, he was otherwise occupied. I let it be noted that Scott and Amiko, who is with him in the studio, went to the varsity before they came here, and Scott Kelly just tried to put on a varsity cap, which everybody listening to the show will be familiar with.
So I'm clearly still the kid that's like looking out the window at the squirrels if I'm playing around with the varsity hat during the interview. Let me get rid of it.
It clearly says something about my ability to keep you engaged. I'll try to do better.
Sorry.
That's fine. Don't worry about it all. I thought it was fun. But the complaint of those Mercury astronauts was when they were first learning about the flights they were going to take, they didn't have any control over. They were passengers. They said, we're like the chimps. And they insisted that they have a little bit to do so they actually could feel like pilots, right?
Yeah, that was, I think, the case back then. You know, I can't recall in the book if it's talked about much, but it's definitely emphasized in the movie that initially our government wasn't even sure what kind of people to put into space, whether they would be more daredevils, you know, in the movie, The Right Stuff, they talk about maybe circus performers or the guy that gets shot out of the cannon because he's used to getting shot out of something. And eventually they decided, hey, seems like test pilots are the best people to do that because they have experience in flight test, in at least the air, not necessarily space. But you know, there was a little bit of a bureaucratic downside to that, and that they wanted to be able to control the vehicle, which is the right thing to do. I mean, if you're especially in something that is so so new, so unfamiliar, so risky, to have the ability to actually manually control the spacecraft is critically important.
And in every one of the vehicles that you flew for NASA, you did have, certainly with the shuttle as commander, you had great control, particularly in the landing stage, but I assume throughout the flight as well.
Yeah, you can fly the space shuttle all the way from 90 seconds after liftoff. Prior to that, it doesn't have the control authority or, you know, I don't remember exactly the exact reason, but there's you're not able to physically control it prior to 90 seconds. But after 90 seconds, you could fly the thing all the way through the rest of the ascent into space manually all the way down to the ground.
Yeah.
But what we really do, you know, those other ways, other times to control it is when you have some kind of a failure. What we normally would do is we would fly the rendezvous and the docking to, like, the space station manually, and then the commander of the shuttle would take over at Mach 1 all the way to landing and wheel stop.
Yep. I think especially on two longer, there are 340 days, but you had previously done 157, something like that?
159. But who's counting?
Yeah. So you spent, well, we will. You spent 520 days in space and traveled over 200 million miles. And yet you don't hold the record.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of my colleagues passed me up for total days in space. I still have the longest single flight of an American. But, you know, records are made to be broken. And that's, you know, hopefully someday people will be spending much more time in space than we have.
So the book centers largely on the 340-day mission. Once you'd done 159 days, why did you tell us that your attitude was, I will not turn down any mission that's presented to me. And when they told you they wanted you to do 340 days in space, it had to have been a daunting idea for you, even though you were willing to accept it.
Well, initially I said no thanks, which is I've done that a few times. My initial reaction is to try to maybe think of someone else that might be better for the job if I didn't really feel like doing it. But when your management and leadership come back and say, hey, we really want you to do this, and I thought more about it. But the way this, in this particular case, in this flight, the way it really worked was that I had just recently gotten back from space when they started talking about a year-long flight. So, you know, the 6 months is a long time in space, and I wasn't too interested because, you know, it's hard. But then as I got further away from it, I thought, you know, I want to fly in space again. I want it to be different, and if I flew another six-month flight, it might not be that different, and a year would make it twice as challenging or more, and I was right. So eventually I came around to the idea, and then when we, you know, there were certain requirements to figure out who the right person was for this, whether it was, experience or medical requirements. When they put this, you know, these different filters on the whole astronaut office, in the end, there was only a couple of people that were eligible.
And at first, they said no to you. They chose someone else, and you went home to see Amiko sitting here with us, and you said, I didn't get chosen, and she helped you figure out how to go back to them.
They decided that I was going to be the person. I was assigned to the flight, and then like 24 hours later, they said, you know, you're actually not medically qualified. Someone had spoken up about some issue with my eyes. And then, you know, I got home, and I told her, and she said, you know, I've never seen you really take no for an answer, you know. You know, take this lying down. So I, came up with a plan and did some research and made my case the next day. And they quickly, you know, rethought the decision and decided I would actually be maybe the better choice to go do this.
Got up there, and I think as you entered the space station, your thought was, "This is crazy. Why am I doing this?"
Yeah, you know, I'd been there previously, 4 years previously, and you get on board and you're like, ooh, it's looking the same, sounding the same, smelling the same, and I'm day one of a year in space.
The International Space Station is pretty remarkable. I don't know what to call it. You call it a place. You say that that you got to the point where you consider it to be essentially a geographical place.
Well, it's a home. It's a workplace. It's a garage. It's an attic. It's a scientific laboratory. It's a lot of things. It's something. It's like a ship. I mean, we don't refer to it as a she like you do in the Navy. Often, naval vessels are referred to in the feminine. But you know, I think maybe it should be. You know, because it's very much like a ship, even though it's a space station. But yeah, it's definitely a place that you, come to appreciate and, really miss, now that I'm not there anymore.
One of the things that's interesting is that your commander of, this remarkable, place in space, and I suppose it sounds glamorous, and there are a lot of people who would think that your life in space is glamorous. But the book goes into great detail describing just how not glamorous a lot of it is. For instance, being awakened in the middle of the night because the toilet is broken.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you wake up, and I wouldn't say it would break in the middle of the night, but you would sometimes go in there and lack of a better word, like the bucket that the urine goes into would get filled up, and then you'd have to replace it before you were able to use it and go back to sleep.
Well, but that was the point. In the middle of the night, you had to deal with this because you say that if everybody else woke up in the morning, they wouldn't have anywhere to pee.
Yeah, yeah, and you can't walk out your back door and use the tree.
You also had problems off and on, and it affected you particularly with the scrubbers, the CO2 scrubbers. What happened to you when there was too much CO2 in the station?
You know, I think everyone has certain symptoms. Because I was going to be there for so long, I wanted to, you know, do my best to make the situation better for me and for the people that followed me. So I kind of raised it as a personal cause and issue. My symptoms when the CO2 got high, and I could actually tell what it was just based on how I felt, what the concentration was in the atmosphere down to like 0.1 or 2 millimeters. So the symptoms I would have was congestion, burning eyes, me just not feeling, you know, 100%, a little bit cognitive deficit, you know, harder to concentrate. And yeah, it kind of became sort of like the protagonist, I guess, of the story.
It really does become that, your constant battle to keep the CO2 levels at an acceptable level. Life on the space station had some certain awfully good moments, I think it's safe to say. You tell us that New Year's Eve was an especially important day because it was a holiday that you celebrated. The Russians celebrated the same day. You celebrated the same day. Let's listen to a message on New Year's Eve.
Welcome aboard the International Space Station. I'm Scott Kelly, along with my Expedition 46 crew members, Tim Kopra and Tim Peak, and we have a New Year's message for you. Happy New Year to all the people of planet Earth. Thank you.
Nice. Very straightforward. Captain Kelly.
Was that all I said?
That's all you said.
Really? Oh, man.
But nevertheless, when you're flying above Earth like that, does it occur to you in any way that, not that you're in a position of being a superior kind of being, but do you feel a sense of responsibility for how you talk to people who, all of us back here, in helping us get a better sense of ourselves and our shared humanity? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a privilege to be able to fly in space and serve your country like this and have this perspective on the planet and the atmosphere. So, yeah, I think it's important to share that perspective with people that don't have the same privilege, absolutely.
Yeah, just so, you also did a Christmas message. Let's listen to that. I don't know if it's any more flowery in terms of the language. Let's listen.
Welcome aboard the International Space Station. I'm Scott Kelly, along with my Expedition 46 crew members, Tim Kopra and Tim Peak, and we have a message for all of you for the holidays. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and happy New Year from the International Space Station.
Yeah, I think I was probably doing that at a time when maybe I would have rather been doing something else. Is kind of how I sounded.
I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I just thought it would be fun to play those.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember that, actually. But I've been in space for Christmas 3 times.
So. Yeah. And that... Your kids aren't with you. You have 2 children, grown. One of them's grown now, right?
Yeah.
The other. Okay. How old are they now?
23 and 14.
Okay. But you're away from them on Christmas 3 years in a row. You had gone through a difficult divorce and had to deal with the fallout from that.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing about being in space for a long period of time. It's not your personal safety, but you always worry about the safety of your family and your loved ones on Earth, because if something happens to them, you're not coming home. And I experienced that firsthand on the flight before that, when my sister-in-law, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, was shot in Tucson, Arizona.
You were watching CNN, which you did frequently, and suddenly the feed was cut off, right?
Well, I didn't notice it was cut off. Oh. I was actually fixing the toilet at the time, but the ground control center in Houston, yeah, they did cut it off because they didn't want me to learn that news from the television.
And you were told there was a private message that, of course, would not be part of the publicly monitored communications mm-hmm. between ground control and the shuttle and the space station. What happened in what you're experiencing of that moment?
So I was working on the toilet. It was a Saturday, January 8th, 2011. And I got a call from the control center, and they, you know, called me to the radio, basically, and said they were going to privatize the space-to-ground channel. The chief of the astronaut office needed to talk to me. She came on about 5 minutes later and said, you know, I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just going to tell you your sister-in-law, Gabby, was shot. A bunch of other people also reported that some people had been killed. And that was kind of it with the phone call. You know, hey, we'll do whatever we can to support you. I said, you know, let me know whatever news you get, even if it's not confirmed. So whatever the news was reporting. I quickly got on the phone with my brother and my family, Amico. And later, the Houston said, as I asked them to, I mean, I asked them to tell me everything. They said, you know, I think the Associated Press was reporting that Gabby had died, and she had not. Got on the phone with a good friend of mine, Tillman Fertitta, in Houston, Texas, because I couldn't get my brother on the phone then because he was already in the air on the way to Tucson. He was in Houston. And Tillman, my good friend, he explained that, or he said to me, he says, you know, I don't know how I know this, but I just know, you know, Gabby's not dead. Doesn't make sense. You know, she would still be in the operating room. You know, she wouldn't, she's still in the operating room, so she's not, she hasn't died. And he was right.
Your brother Mark and your sister-in-law, we all know, have gone on to be really fearless advocates for better gun safety laws. I may be missing something, but have you joined in that effort, or do you leave that to them? Do you participate in any of those activities yourself?
Not in any kind of formal way. I mean, that's their issue. That's, you know, their cause. You know, I have my own opinions, you know, one of which is clearly we need to do something, right? Because what we're doing doesn't really work. So something should be done. Otherwise, people are going to still be killed in this country with guns on a regular basis. So, you know, I'm just shocked that our government basically has chosen to just absolutely ignore this issue and do nothing about it.
Yeah, she's made a remarkable comeback, but clearly your family still has to deal with the aftermath of that. She is still has issues that are probably going to be with her for the rest of her life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What's that like for you? You talk about the fact that you immediately liked her when Mark introduced
you
to her.
Yeah, so she's got some, you know, significant disabilities as a result of the shooting. And it's something that, you know, she and her family is going to have to live with for the rest of her life. You know, in some ways, you know, because she was a public person, she has meaningful work to do to help in this area. So that's a positive thing that she has that to occupy her time and to do something very important. But, yeah, like you said, it's something that, you know, her especially has to live with for the rest of her life.
Let's take another break right now. My guest is retired astronaut Scott Kelly. He spent more consecutive days in space than any other American, including a 340-day mission as commander of the International Space Station. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. I'm talking to retired astronaut Scott Kelly about his new book, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Experience. You do, in the book, give us some sense of your political, of the fact that you are a political being in many ways. You write that you follow the news from space, especially political news, and you're watching the presidential election unfold in 2015. And you basically say, like the hurricanes I watch from above, a storm seems to be gathering on the horizon that will shape our political landscape for years to come.
Yeah, and I you know, it was funny when, you know, during the primary, we had conversations on board about, you know, how that was shaping up. And it was, you know, I think the suspicion I had about, you know, the discourse in this country that was going to result of, you know, from that election was right, because it's, you know, pretty tough out there in the political world right now.
You say, what the hell is going on down there? I hope that up there you didn't divide into the sort of partisan factions that some of our families have got right here on Earth.
No.
That would be very difficult, I would
think.
No,
we you know, your partners, crewmates, teammates, even issues between nations, the United States and Russia in particular, don't really affect our ability to get along and to be friends, because what is most important in space is that we take care of one another. We work towards our, you know, common goals.
Yeah.
We do it in a very, you know, peaceful and friendly way. And, you know, because we all, you know, we share this planet. We share issues that are important to all of us. It's kind of, I'm just shocked sometimes about how things have unfolded. Yeah.
You dealt with another really difficult tragedy on February 1st, 2003, when the space shuttle Columbia, this was, I think, a Saturday, as I recall, and you were on Earth, you were basically home, and you were listening into the communications of what was going on, right? Am I right? Have I got this? You were.
I was watching on TV.
Okay,
yeah.
Watching on TV, and of course, we all know. Let's listen to what happened.
A considerable emergency going on right now throughout the space community, throughout NASA, at Mission Control. One can only imagine.
NASA says none of the seat restraints, helmets, and spacesuits used by the doomed crew of the space shuttle Columbia worked well as the ship disintegrated during reentry.
The suffered a huge loss. Seven shuttle astronauts on board, including the first ever Israeli.
You had several friends who were flying the Columbia that day. But one in particular, I think, Laurel Clark.
So three of my classmates were on Columbia. Four other of my colleagues that, you know, I wasn't as close with them as I was the three other people from my astronaut class. And, you know, like you said, it was a national tragedy, and you know, really unfortunate.
Her son and your daughter Samantha, they played together.
Yeah, they were close at the time, and Laurel used to pick Samantha up and take her and Ian to the zoo and on the weekends, and we would spend, you know, my family and her family would spend time together.
So when that happens, when Samantha learns of the death of a mom who used to take her to play with her son, how do you talk to your children about that?
You know, you explain to them as best you can what happened, and you tell them, you know, Laurel was, and the rest of the crew members were doing something they felt was very important. They knew it was risky, although, you know, no one goes into this thinking that they're going to get killed. They think they might, and they hope they don't, but, you know, and that, you know, she would, Laurel, and I think the other crew members would want us to, you know, press ahead, and probably to best honor their memory and their sacrifice would be for us to continue to fly in space and do this, you know, these incredible risky things because of the, you know, the benefits of doing that.
What probably made it harder was that you ended up being part of the crew that went out to look for pieces of the Columbia wreckage and, unfortunately, look for remains of some of the crew members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you go back to the right stuff. You say it reminds you of some of the pages you read of test pilots crashing in the desert and dealing with the aftermath of what happened to them.
Yeah, it was quite an odd thing that space shuttle broke apart over Texas, and you know, the people that worked closest with the crew members, fellow astronauts, engineers, instructors, were only a 2-hour drive from the crash site.
Yeah. On a lighter note, what the heck were you doing putting on a gorilla suit on the International Space Station?
Why not a gorilla suit?
Your brother Mark loved this idea, right?
Well, it was his idea. He says, I'm sending you a gorilla suit. I said, what? Why a gorilla suit? And actually, it got a lot of attention, some negative from a lot of the, some folks that, like to criticize NASA. You know, why would NASA spend all this money to fly a gorilla suit? Well, NASA spends money to fly foam and packing material and sometimes lead ballast. So it really doesn't cost anything to fly a gorilla suit. And when I thought about it, I thought about how sometimes I'll go to a school and try to talk to kids, and there's always this kid like me that was in the back of the room not paying attention. Well, a gorilla in space, you cannot not pay attention to that.
All right. You, the final day came, and you departed the space station to come back. You talk about the reentry coming back in. You came back in a Russian capsule, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you describe at one point in the book trying to prepare other colleagues of yours for what it was like to fly that Russian capsule, or not fly it, to sit in it as it dropped like a stone traveling at extraordinary speeds. What is that like?
It's crazy, actually, thinking about it. You undock from the space station, you fire some engines to slow down by just a few hundred miles an hour, and then right after that, the three sections are exploded apart. Some of the pieces are actually hitting the window right by the side of your head. You can see stuff, debris flying outside. As you hit the atmosphere, you're in this 3,000-degree fireball. It gets hot inside. The window, you have pieces of the heat shield flying by. It looks like, just white hot burning material. Eventually the window just burns to a crisp and you can't see outside anymore. It's kind of like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel, but while you're on fire. But as soon as you realize you're not going to die, the most fun you've ever had in your life. If I hated being in space for a year, I'd do it all over again just for that last 20 minutes.
Well, you say the same thing about your spacewalks, that it's you, when you think about them, it's after they're over that they're really fun.
Yeah, it's type 2 kind of fun. Type 1 fun is the roller coaster. It's fun while you're doing it. Type 2 fun is the things that are fun when you're done. And, it's definitely that.
Scott Kelly, you close your book with some wonderful observations about what you learned. Do you mind if I read a couple of them to you?
You can read all of them.
We'll let people buy the book and read all of them. But I'll tell you a few that I picked out that I thought were wonderful. I've learned that nothing feels as amazing as water. The night my plane landed in Houston and I finally got to go home, I did exactly what I've been saying all along I would do. Walked in the front door, walked out the back door, and jumped into my swimming pool, still in my flight suit. You've said, I've learned how important it is to sit and eat with other people. While I was in space, I saw on TV one day a scene of people sitting down to eat a meal together. The sight moved me with an unexpected yearning. And then you say something we talked about at the very beginning of this conversation. I've learned that grass smells great, and wind feels amazing, and rain is a miracle. I will try to remember how magical these things are for the rest of my life. It sounds very romantic.
I'm a poet, and I didn't know it.
Scott Kelly, as we end our conversation, you've been retired from the program now for a while. Do you want to go back? Do you miss going into space?
Every day.
Scott Kelly, your book is Endurance. It's a wonderful, wonderful read, and I really appreciate your spending so much time with us on Two-Way Street. Thanks a lot for being here.
No, my pleasure.
You can learn more about Scott Kelly and his book on the Two-Way Street Facebook page and at our website at gpb.org/TWS. That's all the time we have for today's show. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. Tyler Morris is our engineer. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again next week for another Two-Way Street.